气。Good morning. Sorry for that dead air there, as we say in the radio biz. And you are listening to WMFO 91.5 FM, Tufts Free Forum, commercial-free, community-based radio. And now for a slice of that community base with socialist alternative radio, talk and music from a working class, democratic socialist perspective, taking over from Ear Buddies. And haven't been here in a couple weeks, and we are looking forward to this show. Diego was going to guest host today, but he couldn't make it, I guess. So we are, you're going to have me as your host. My name's Jeff, and we'll be here till 1 p.m. And just sort of headlines of today's show, we'll be talking about the generalized economy for working people, like what, you know, let me make that clear. Quote, millions of Americans are just one paycheck away from financial disaster. Now, you may have heard that before. You may have heard that, you know, phrase before, or that concept before. But more and more data is coming out to say, yeah, that's the case. Wait a minute. Nobody's got any savings. And of course, the articles are usually filled with contradictions, implying that, you know, it's just a question of personal choice and not an economy that's deliberately called, you know, deliberately driving down wages in order to increase profits. That's called capitalism. And then we're going to talk about free public transit and put that into very concrete context of, in Worcester, Mass, the second largest city in New England, there was just a study saying this is the way to go, by a generalized, like, kind of urban think tank, saying that, yeah, you know, the way to go is really to just have the transit be free. And that would actually save a lot of money and increase ridership, et cetera, decrease pollution. They don't get into that, but that's, you know, the case. And then you see the Democratic dominated, if not Democratic completely populated by Democrats. I'm not sure, I have to double check on that, but the Worcester City Council is dominated by the Democrats. Basically, having a bunch of Democrats, not all of them, but a bunch of them say, maybe the bus system is obsolete and we should just privatize the whole thing. They don't use that word, but that's what they mean, and start having everyone do Uber and Lyft. Meanwhile, out in Seattle, the socialist city councilor, Shama Sawant, a member of Socialist Alternative and an open socialist, elected twice to city council, now running for a third term in office. The Shama Sawant campaign and Social Alternative are calling for free public transit out in Seattle and knocking on people's doors and talking about the campaign, finding out that it's quite a popular demand, and that, you know, it should be done. I mean, it's needed. It's very much needed. I was out in Seattle helping with the re-election campaign last time around, and there was clearly an expansion of public transit out there because the big, you know, big giants of Microsoft, big corporate monolith of Microsoft and Amazon are headquartered out there, and they want to, you know, suck in the workers to exploit every day, and the roads just can't handle that done on a car basis. There's already huge traffic jams out there. Apparently Boston has got the worst commute in the country. I find that hard to believe after getting a taste of Seattle's, but the Boston commute is completely horrible and ridiculous. And while we're here, just a quick editorial comment, which based about everything on the show is an editorial comment, but backed up by facts and by analysis. And basically, this commute in Boston, I mean, even if you made mass transit free as it stands now in its current capability, it wouldn't work because it's not flexible enough. There's not enough trains. There's not enough buses. It's just not flexible enough for real schedules. And of course, it has to be, of course, making it free would be a huge incentive to try to work your schedule into that. But even so, you know, you want to have mass transit that's, you know, flexible enough to deal with families, basically people with children, to deal with elderly people, to deal with people that can't just cram into a subway car and then rush off. You want it to be safe. You want it to be clean. You want it to be 24 hours, basically, or close to that. I've experienced that having traveled in Europe. The best example that comes to me, and then I was in France for a while. In France, excellent public transit, but the main subway in Paris, for example, closes too early. But excellent, better trains going to the suburbs and outer outlying areas, and within Paris itself, the trains, when they're running, again, not late enough, really, really excellent service. In terms of the Netherlands, I have to say, it was trolley and bus service. I don't remember being on a subway in the Netherlands. Maybe I was. But I remember being out really late at night a few times and still having full access to multiple routes going, really crisscrossing the country, you know, and going far. And it's a small country, but still hooking up cities late at night, being able to go visit, stay out late. And then they stay out very late in the Netherlands, believe me, for the most part. And so that was like a huge eye-opener of what's possible for public transit. And, you know, light rail, trolleys, buses, subways, it's there to be built, you know. And once it's built, it's you know, under capitalism, it's all about short-term maximization of profit. And so you have capitalists that would actually gain in the long term, not that I care, because I don't believe in trickle-down theory, but you have capitalists that are actually gained from mass transit in terms of increased ability to get workers in to exploit and increased consumers be able to get to the places. Even now with you know, delivery and so on, there's still people that need to go to brick-and-mortar stores and need to shop and so on. And of course, restaurants and so on. There's places, entertainment, places where you still go, some people at least still go or try to if they can afford it. And mass transit would exponentially increase the number of consumers going out and doing things. I don't like that word consumers, but I'm just using it because right now I'm like playing pro-capitalist for a second and saying, well, okay, they would even get something from this. But short-term maximization of profit is gone under capitalism. They hate taxes that tracks from that short-term maximization of profit. So they don't want to pay for, even though it would benefit them, they don't want to pay for any increase in mass transit. In fact, they're trying to destroy it in Worcester. And they don't want to, have increased taxes. They don't want to, even contemplate, some of them, state-run, enterprises, you know, state-run mass transit, publicly owned mass transit. They want to privatize everything. That's partially what's going on in Worcester, again, with attacking the free transit proposal that's out there. Today's show, we're also going to get into more of that Shama Sawant campaign, also the recent setbacks for abortion rights, some union news if we have time, and we're going to jump in, but first we're going to take a quick musical interlude here, and I can't really vouch for this song. It's going to be kind of an experiment. We'll see how it goes. I played it once in the show before, but I can't remember if I liked it or not. So let's just see how that goes, and maybe we'll switch over to something else in a minute. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective, and we're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And thanks for tuning in, and enjoy the music. We'll be right back.
No class, but lots of dough. Got a gold-plated ego. I go to church and say amen. Make America great again. Now what else would you expect from a reality show clown? When chaos rules the day, well, it's a world turned upside down.
just a cheap sideshow attraction. Using weapons of mass distraction. He's always looking to pick a fight. A Twitter tantrum every night. Elephant turns mark the way. When the circus comes to town, when the village idiot leads the fray, well, it's a world turned upside down. Now he's looking to build a wall, make it nice and tall.
They're bringing crime, they're rapists, very fine people on both sides.
His police will shoot you in your car, just for the color that you are. Now are you really surprised? Our smiles have turned to frowns. Well, open up your eyes, it's a world turned upside down. With North Korea, he's always fussing, just a puppet for the Russians. His bad news is real, not fake, America's most embarrassing mistake. He's got his hand in corporate's pocket, and the other up ladies' gowns. When a sleazeball leads the way, it's a world turned upside down. Between his ears is not much of nothing. Got his finger on the button. So go to church and say amen. Make America hate again. Upside down. Upside down. Upside down. Upside down. Upside down. Upside down, upside down, upside down.
Okay, that was Things with Wings doing a song called Upside Down. I do remember that song now. Did play it once before. Yeah, I sort of admire the effort, but it was just such a mix of liberal cliches with a few good lines about Trumpo that I don't think I'm going to play it again. But, you know, that's just me. But like I said, I admire the effort. It's just like, I don't know, puppet of the Russians. You really believe that? That's the thing with liberals is they, the progressivism ends at usually some sort of jingoism, some sort of, defense of capitalism, many times even racism, you know, and that's, there's severe limits to that political philosophy. But in America, people are taught to think that there's only two political trends out there, only two political ways to be, conservative or liberal. But both of those are pro-capitalist. So what happens to people like us, those of us that are socialists, revolutionary socialists, you know, where are we on that spectrum? We're not there. We are supposedly off the radar, and yet polling data shows more and more people are interested in socialism or have a favorable attitude towards the word socialism. Now, as we've said on the show before, that could lead to a lot of different interpretations of socialism, and that's okay. And we're gonna, let's see, got a little technical thing here. We're gonna see if we can do this right. WMFO, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question I have to ask you.
Again, okay, go ahead.
Could you give me just a yes or a no answer?
No, never can do that. Sorry. But what's the question?
Are you a communist?
See, that's not a yes or no. That's not a yes or no answer. Yes and no. Communism is associated with what existed in Russia after the Stalinists took over. All sorts of repression, all sorts of bureaucratic dictatorship over the economy. No, not that kind, not that. We're not that. But that goal of communism, of equality, of everyone having a decent life, internationalism, yes. So hope that answered your question. Any other questions?
No. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. Yeah, that was a good question. The terms get thrown around. Communist, socialist, what do they all mean? Well, it unfortunately, it shifts. You know, it shifts over time. Socialist right now, for some people, if writing in the, for people like Bernie Sanders or people writing in the, Alexandria Cortez, people writing in like the Nation, they're sort of trying to redefine socialism as a gentle form of capitalism, like the New Deal under Roosevelt or Johnson's so-called Great Society period of increasing welfare payments and so on. Well, those are capitalist times in American history. Those were the Roosevelt administration was capitalism was not capitalism still existed. Made huge profits even during the Depression, sections of the capitalists. And when World War II started, made huge profits off the war, the capitalists in the United States. There was never bringing the, you know, masses of the economy, the big corporations under public ownership under the Roosevelt administration. And there were a lot of problems with the New Deal, some of which we've talked about on the show before, that it was, they would tend to have these public works programs implemented at the worst moments of the New Deal, and then right before elections also, and when Roosevelt got reelected, they would cut back on the program severely. The programs had different wages for Southern workers and Northern workers, lower wages for the South, higher wages for the North. The Roosevelt administration itself, including how it doled out public welfare programs, was very much tied in with the Jim Crow, racist Southern politicians who were all Democrats at the time, or mostly all Democrats at the time, in the South and during the 1930s. Fast forward to Johnson, Great Society period. Again, no tax on capitalism, nothing taken under public ownership, just increased welfare payments. And basically, and some, you know, programs got enacted at a time of, in the 60s, during Johnson's period in office, a period of boom in the economy where the capitalists could afford to give some concessions faced with a stronger labor movement at the time here in the United States. And that was good, but it was only due to pressure. And the minute that pressure was off, starting in the 70s, early 70s, and even in the late 60s, even some people would argue, but let's say the early 70s, they started to do away with a lot of the increases in programs that help people weren't able to survive well under capitalism, that weren't able to sell their labor as the economy started to turn. You had the big recession in 74, 75. So it's a real, to call the Roosevelt administration or Roosevelt a socialist, to call Johnson a socialist, this is completely wrong. A socialist is someone who wants to bring democracy to the economy and say we should actually vote as a people, not just here in the United States, but internationally, for the sake of survival, for the sake of humanity, we need to vote on what needs to be produced from all the big industries and all the big transportation and so on. What needs to be produced? How can it be produced without destroying the environment, without destroying the ecology we need to survive in? And how can it be distributed for human need and not for profit of a tiny few? So this is the opposite of capitalism. Capitalism is all about profit for a tiny few. And if that destroys the environment, if that destroys people's lives, too bad. That's too bad. And you don't vote on those decisions. They make decisions in corporate boardrooms and then in the government that they control through the big corporations. And then they say, okay, here we're going to close this, all these stores down or all these factories down. We're going to dump stuff here, nuclear waste here, something over there. We're going to, do trade. We're going to move industries over to other countries where there's cheaper labor. And there we're going to hurt those workers and hurt the environment there. And all that, all those decisions, we don't vote directly on those decisions. We don't. Even the political components, like, say, NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, which they have a new name for. Yeah, politicians voted for those, and we vote for the politicians. But then you get into ways that the two-party system is kept, the duopoly, as some people call it, is kept in power. So you don't have a wide variation in terms of economic programs. Like most, the Democratic Party, you'll notice, didn't try to fight NAFTA, the new NAFTA at all. Back in the 90s, NAFTA was considered a horrible thing by the labor movement and by a lot of other people, and there was a lot of resistance to it, and there was an attempt to get a labor party going in this country, which I was a part of and other people were part of that were involved with unions or other people that weren't in unions, to get a labor party off the ground, to get a serious third party off the ground, because a lot of it was NAFTA. It was the last straw for a lot of labor leaders that had been just writing out checks for the Democratic Party and sending out people to campaign for Democrats, which is unfortunately still happening, that some people don't learn, and takes a lot to get new leadership in, which I hope is happening more and more, because to support the Democrats is a real dead end. And obviously supporting the Republicans is no alternative. So that attempt to get a Labor Party going ultimately failed in this country. You should read about it. It was called first was called Labor Party Advocates, then was called the Labor Party. And you could Google Tony Mazzocchi. That's a hard name to spell. Sorry. Mazzocchi, M-A-S-S. I don't even know how to spell it. M-A-S-S-O-C-H-I, something like that. Or Z. I think there was a Z there instead of the two S's, Mazzocchi. Or just try Labor Party U.S., see what happens with that. And if it's based in the 90s, then you'll get a picture, somewhat of a picture of how that worked. Problem was that the labor leaders that were involved in the attempt to get a Labor Party going, which was a good attempt initially, they couldn't cut the cord with the Democratic Party. They just are really into the maybe they'll do something for us, you know. Take for example the supporting Obama, you know, in 2008, labor leadership got behind Obama based mainly on the promise of the Democrats putting forward legislation called EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act. And the Employee Free Choice Act was supposed to change labor law that the Democrats themselves brought in initially back in the 30s and into the 40s as well with Taft-Hartley, basically made certain rules about making it hard to organize unions in this country. And the Employee Free Choice Act made those rules, took away some of those rules, would make it easier. In other words, you'd go into a place and if the majority of people signed cards saying they were for a union, then you could, as a union, then get an election much quicker than you can now. And if the election was won, there was a rule in EFCA that you had to have a year to negotiate a contract, or there would be mandatory arbitration to a contract after the first year. And this would, so right now what happens in reality in organizing unions is that you can organize unions. Unions are being organized a lot, but not nearly enough. And so what happens is if you try to organize a union, there's all sorts of ways to delay what they call an election for the union, the vote for the union. Then there's all sorts of ways to delay indefinitely, meaning forever sometimes, signing a first contract. And there are, you know, if the union is strong enough, they can force the companies to do that, but it takes a lot, especially for a first time union contract. That takes a huge effort a lot of workers are competing against, even a union competing against multinational corporations that, you know, band together and try to stop unions and pay millions and billions of dollars around the world trying to stop unions, because that, again, cuts into that, you know, that short-term maximization of profit, that god of capitalism that's so damaging and so destructive to everybody. Even the capitalists themselves, they just don't care because they're greedy and, you know, they don't see any alternative. But there's an alternative. It's called socialism. And it's about, again, bringing democracy to the economy so it can be voted on what's going to be produced, how it's going to be produced in a sustainable way. And that's a big word for basically making sure it's not polluting the crap out of everything and destroying the planet fit for human life, to, you know, making it unfit for human life, making sure that it is fit for human life through sustainability. And then how things would be distributed. Are they be distributed based on profit, based on profit mongering, based on selling, or distributed based on need, what people need? And you would vote on that. And that would include voting on how labor, our labor as working people, is going to be used. We would have control over our own labor, not in an individual sense, in the sense of, yeah, you still leave a job, quit a job, whatever, so you don't have total control over the conditions at which you're, at which jobs are exist in, but you would have control with other working people and with the communities and with regions and nations to set up worker-run, in the general sense, worker-run operations. I'm not talking about co-ops here, little co-ops here and there. I'm talking about plan of a democratically decided economic plan in an area, a region, a town, whatever. Like, the resources, including our labor, is going towards this because we think this is important, whatever this is. You know, if it's growing food in a certain area, or whether it's distributing food from that area to another area, whether that in the region that makes most sense there, people decide, yeah, that's good farmland, that's a good place to, there's a good place to have a truck hub or whatever, hopefully something else other than trucks, you know, a train hub or whatever, and we're gonna help build that, we're gonna help maintain that, we're gonna help use that, and the food's gonna go out, and then in turn we're gonna get other things into the region to help us have better lives there, maybe get housing built, maybe get recreational facilities built, get whatever people decide they want in their areas, you know, sports facilities, better, you know, have childcare, free elderly care. That would mean a lot more infrastructure put into daycare centers and into elderly, I hate to say the word homes because it brings back like nursing homes, but, you know, elderly living facilities and so on. So the possibilities, once you jump that hurdle of it has to be for profit for a few rich people, are endless. That's why socialists have written a lot about the possibilities of a socialist society after capitalism, but they haven't written these blueprints out, you know, this is exactly how things will go, because they have a hard time even themselves imagining how the possibilities in a system where it's not tied to the private profit of a few, but tied to the social good, what people need and want, so everyone has a decent life, or more than a decent life, actually. And then, you know, there's all sorts of questions that come up about that. Well, what if everything is free, and why would I have to work and all that? And, well, because work is what makes things happen. So imagine a society where all of us have gotten together in a certain city, or sent out representatives, not like the Democratic Republican parties, but real representatives, like just people like us, and said, okay, we really want to build these daycare facilities for little kids, for newborns and so on around in these areas in the city. And that's going to take a certain amount of labor and so on, and we need that labor. The people, especially with kids, right, or people that care about kids, there's self-interest there. But also, there's people that just want to see if that goes well, then other things we do are going to go better, you know. And basically, and you try to convince people. You say, look, this is really worth doing. We voted on it. Let's do it. And then there's still some people that are like, nah, you know, I'm just going to sit back. I don't really care about kids, you know, blah, blah. Well, that happens now. Even with a coercive, forced way of getting people to work, work or starve, work or be homeless and all that, there's still people that opt out, and a system can handle some of that. But if it becomes like the norm, or people really don't like it, then what happens? Well, what happens when you're with family or friends and you're trying to do something and somebody's not working? What do? You put pressure on them, frankly. You peer pressure. You say, look, you're not doing anything. It's not fair to us. So when it comes time to eat, maybe you get a little less or something. Maybe you, I don't know, you really need to be helping us here, you know? And most people will be convinced of that. Most people want to be liked. Most people want to be in society, you know? You'll still have some outliers. You'll still have some people that don't want to do anything. A democratic socialist system can handle that, you know? And I don't think most people would, seeing their lives improving, seeing they have more leisure time, seeing they have better ways of living, better, more choices, I really don't see a huge opt-out. I really don't see a huge, I'm just going to sit back and be lazy. Because the how you would look at those people would be with contempt. You would just really hate the really lazy people. I'm not talking about people taking a rest. I'm not talking about older people. I'm talking about people that like really just like, they could be doing a good job at something that people decided they need, and they're not opting out. They even were part of the decision, and they're not doing it. The pressure on those people, just from emotional, just like psychological pressure, would be intense, because we're human beings, we're social animals. We're like, yeah, we need to do these things to survive. You need to help too. You need to put your share in. You need to cooperate, or we're all going to die. You know, like it would come down to basic convincing people that it's both materially in terms of better lives, but also just like in terms of emotion and psychology, that yeah, you're part of the society. You need to then act like it, and you can negotiate all sorts of ways that work would happen, that work wouldn't happen, that people would have stuff and people wouldn't have stuff, and it would be a negotiation. It would be decision making. Now it's just decided by basically who has the money and who exploits other people's labor and who destroys and exploits nature, and that's the most unfair system I can think of. You know, I mean, most of human history, and I'm not saying you can go back to this, you can't go back to it, but most of human history was tribal societies where you had a subsistence level of survival based on hunting, fishing, gathering, some early agriculture, some early domestication of animals and so on, and not much technology. And, that was most of human history. And I'm not saying you can or want to go back to that, but the point is that it was a period where people cooperated, people lived collectively and tribally because every person had a role to play. Every person helped the survival of the tribe. That's kind of the way most people act, even under capitalism. Capitalism really messes people up and creates some very sociopathic, society-hating people, very violent people, and so on. But most people that I know, most people that you know, they want to be good people. They want to help. They want to do work. They want to create a better life for the future, for future generations. And that's based on that the evolution that we've gone under as human beings for most of our time on the planet of being in tribal societies. Now, that's changed fast and changed drastically, but there's still, even under capitalism, you still have basically work done socially. And this is part of socialism. This is part of socialist theory. It looks as objectively as possible at society and says, well, look, here's all these people doing the work. They have all this potential power, but they're not paid hardly anything. And they are treated badly, and they have worse living conditions, and et cetera, et cetera. And here's a tiny, tiny minority of people. Really statistically insignificant, except that they own the means of production. They own the things that make things. They own the things that transport things. They own the things in the stores once they get there. They own the things that are delivered to your house until you buy them from them. And there's a whole government in place mainly to protect their ability to privately own social production or socialized production of things. So in other words, it takes, that old cliche, it takes a village to raise a child. Let's expand that. It takes an entire population to make work, to do the work to keep an economic system like capitalism running, right? But that population, that masses and masses of working people are not in control. We don't own the things that we produce. It's like one of the first things I read as a socialist. Well, actually, it wasn't one of the first, but it was sort of soon after I became a socialist, was a book with a funny name. It's got a name called The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist. That's a weird name. but it was written by a carpenter. It was written by a worker. And it was all about his time as a carpenter in England. I forget the time frame. I think it was late 1800s, early 1900s. I'd have to double check that. And he was a union worker. And he would argue with his, a lot of the book is like him having discussions with his coworkers about the need for the union, need for to show the problems of capitalism, the need to change the system. And it's a really long book. So you have to pick and choose the pieces you focus on, but it's really good. And it's, he basically, you know, shows the what they went through, when they were non-union and so on, the suffering they went through, and even the suffering, even after being in a union, but living better, being able to negotiate better and so on. But, there's a lot of, that's just like one little example of, a place, time, when workers themselves, working people themselves imagined alternatives, saw alternatives were possible, bigger socialist movement then at the time he was writing that in England, then now there's still a big socialist movement, there. And it comes right from a working person, you know, really, really, good stuff. But there's a lot of that. I'm going to have to segue here, get back into the main drift of the show. We used to start every show with a little quick explanation of, hey, what is the base? What is socialism? Well, it's bringing democracy to the economy. Instead of just voting on a lot of things you don't get to vote on, instead of not voting on a lot of things you should be voting on, like big decisions that affect how resources are going to be used in society, in your town, and beyond that, you're at best voting for politicians that are basically rich, usually owned by the corporations in various ways. They don't see an alternative to capitalism. They're doing well under capitalism. They like it. They don't care about the future. They don't care about the environment. They don't care about the people that aren't doing well, which is the vast majority. We got some information about that in a second. So instead of electing representatives that are far removed from the actual decisions that need to be made and far removed from your lives, from our lives, we need to be voting directly on things that affect our lives most directly, and that's things to do with work and things to do with our communities and how we live. And if you need representation for that, you want representation much closer to the ground. You want representation from other working people. You want representation, more representation, and you want, on top of that, direct votes on things, as well as votes from representatives. So we'll always come back to that one way or another. That discussion about what is socialism. And again, the caller asked, you know, are you a communist? Is this communism? Again, no, it's not the communism that came about after the Stalinists took over in Russia and in the late 20s, mid to late 20s, they basically, took a revolution that started to build socialism and they turned it into something else. But that wasn't done in a vacuum. That was done because there was invasion right after the revolution, soon after, about 6 months after, to a year after, there was invasion of Russia by 19 capitalist countries' armies, including the United States. It went in from the West and from Siberia into Russia. We're not taught that history, but that's there. You can look it up. And they were trying to restore capitalism. So any attempt to build socialism in Russia at that time all of a sudden had to be to defend, a lot of resources had to go to just defend the revolution. And then there was an economic embargo in place. There was tons of propaganda. So the invasion, the economic embargo just means don't let any goods or services go in or out of the country. Don't let the country sell anything on the world market, whatever. And on top of that, massive propaganda against the whole attempt to set up socialism that resulted in a bloody civil war that threw an already kind of weak economy, even made it based on capitalism. Capitalism in Russia was pretty weak compared to other capitalist countries. It threw it back, even advanced capitalist countries, industrialized countries, threw it back even further. So after the Civil War, the main decision making in the country that working people had created and used and it's very close to what I was just describing a minute ago, Soviets, meaning councils, workers' councils all over the place, in workplaces, in cities, in areas, in types of work. Those councils were literally drained of a lot of their best activists through the Civil War. Some were killed. The economy was so bad they couldn't go back to their old jobs. They couldn't go back to their old places they lived. They had to start anew. And that meant, in many cases, subsistence farming. And the whole economy was thrown back. And the pressure didn't let up, even though the Civil War defeated the attempt of the rich, czarist, influenced, and capitalist coming back to power in Russia. And it's chased off the invaders, including the United States. It happened at such a cost that it couldn't just start rebuilding socialism again. Although it tried, and that was the big battle, really. The real battle was the Civil War, and then another big battle after the Civil War. And unfortunately, the forces of democratic socialism, the forces that wanted to rebuild socialism into the mass Soviets, the mass workers' councils again, failed. And instead, you had this bureaucracy come up, led by Stalin, who they basically made the Soviets, got rid of the democracy of the workers' councils of the Soviets, kept them around as just showpieces. They weren't really making the decisions. Launched political terror against political enemies. Went and repressed other nationalities around the borders of Russia and sometimes within Russia. And didn't create a democratic planning of the economy. Created instead a bureaucratic planning of the economy, where a few bureaucrats controlled by the central Stalinist regime decided what was going to be produced. And so on. And even that, as messed up as that was, in Russia, it was an improvement over capitalism. And in many countries, you found after the Russian Revolution, and even through, into the 60s and 70s, countries in Africa, Asia, and so on, when they overthrew capitalism, the existing sort of model for socialism, which it really wasn't, but still it was something that was surviving, outside of capitalism, was Stalinism, and they would usually take on elements of that. Sometimes, people wanted real socialism, and there was the fighting and discussion and so on about that. But oftentimes, most of the time, it was mimicking Stalinism. So you'd have a bureaucracy, with a powerful army and so on, not accountable to the people. And the Russian Civil War was fought by people's militias, by people who wanted to fight to defend socialism against, the capitalists coming back. In many countries where the Stalinists took over, or Stalinist parties took over, they again used their armies to repress any political opposition, even from the left. And so set up bureaucratic planning. And bureaucratic planning was superior to the anarchy of capitalism in the sense of production, but just really not good as far as people's rights went, really not good as far as people having a decision making. And that's what people need. You need one of the theoreticians of Marxism, and actually a leader in the big fight for socialism, was Leon Trotsky. And he said the workers, under real socialism, the economy needs democracy like the body needs oxygen. In other words, it can't function without it. So to really, how do you plan an economy for a complex thing like an economy, like what's to be produced, how to produce it, how to distribute it, of tens and hundreds of millions of people, how do you do that with a few bureaucrats meeting in a few rooms here or there in certain regions or maybe in one centralized area? Answer is you don't. It is not going to work. And it didn't work. And, some people that defend Stalinism, they would say it didn't work because of all the pressure from outside. And the pressure from outside in terms of the U.S., the Cold War, U.S. pressure, led by the U.S., but other countries as well, to always choke off and always threaten militarily the Russia, created that a lot of resources made it that a lot of resources in Russia had to go to the military that could have gone to other things. But still, the fundamental planning was flawed. In the sense of, not in terms of capitalism, is actually they were able to do more to solve some of the problems that capitalism created than capitalism itself could do, but they also didn't create socialism. And you needed to create socialism not only just to everyone could have a decent life, better than a decent life, an improving life, but also to ward off capitalism, to stop capitalism from actually reemerging in areas, including in ultimately in Russia itself. You know, the people that defend Stalinism, I'm always like, you all, the Stalinists, gave up what you consider socialism. You gave it up without a fight, you know? So what's going on with that? If that was such a superior thing, if that was real socialism, then why did it just collapse, essentially? And again, they'll point to the pressure from the West. And yeah, but that existed for many years. Why at a certain moment, why at a certain point in time, it wasn't one moment, but why at a certain point in time did it kind of collapse? Why did that happen in other countries that brought on the Stalinist model, you know? And that's, they don't have answers for that, really. They just say, oh, it's a few bad apples, a few bad leaders. No, it's a bad system. Bureaucratic planning versus democratic planning. You need a democratic planning. You know, you could say, well, some places have survived, right? Like Cuba, right? Well, Cuba's an island. I wouldn't use it as an example either way of capitalism or socialism, even if it was up and functioning. You can't have socialism in one country, in one, especially not in a little island. It has to be international. What exists in Cuba is a Stalinist-based sort of bureaucratic planning did increase living standards compared to capitalism. No doubt about that. That happened in Russia as well. But there's limits to that. And they've reached those limits. And the way they overcame those limits was first through aid from Russia and then aid from various places. Like, for example, when Chavez was in power in Venezuela, they got cheap oil and so on. But that doesn't always work. And there are times where the Cuban economy gets weaker. And then they bring in elements of capitalism to try and they think that's going to help. And it's not helping. It's making things worse. And yeah, you have survivability versus viability. You have, you know, meaning going beyond survivability and being able to spread the revolution beyond Cuba. Now, Cubans did, and this is a good thing, they did send out, you know, doctors to other countries in Latin America. They've helped out militarily sometimes with fights against, capitalist dictators and so on in other countries. But again, that's not really spreading a revolution because their model isn't really that great. It's not like they can go up to other countries and say, yeah, you know, this is a democratic planned economy that we have, and here's what you can do to implement it. And they don't even try something like that, basically. To consider the creation of socialism as some sort of experiment where you're dealing with a laboratory conditions and you're left on your own to build socialism in a petri dish or something is insane. If you're trying to create socialism, you're creating it in the real world with the capitalist powers trying everything they can do to stop it. And that's what happened to Russia. Now, Russia, but it's not inevitable. The Russian Revolution did start to spread to other countries in 1919 in Hungary, in Germany, after World War One. In many other countries, there were revolutionary movements at the time that could have, especially the one in Germany with an advanced capitalist country, if that had, economy, if that had succeeded, more resources could have gone back to Russia. You have a whole different period, a whole different situation. So the question of looking back at history and saying, well, you know, these socialist revolutions failed, quote unquote, but looking at that without putting in a political context is useless. Even if I was pro-capitalist, I would want to, hopefully, be smart enough or whatever. I guess I wouldn't, if I was pro-capitalist, believe in a Marxist method of looking at material reality to figure out, and looking at dialectics, how things change, to figure out the processes at work in history. So I don't know, maybe I would never come across this, but hopefully someone trying to be somewhat scientific would look and say, well, wait a minute. So that thing called socialism didn't work, but when they tried it, they were immediately attacked by the capitalist countries, both militarily and economically, and the propaganda churned out by the capitalist countries against any attempt to bring about socialism. Those might have been factors, don't you think? And now we've got socialism in a lot of cases, a lot of places, including in the U.S., reemerging as a generalized idea that people, more and more people, want to find out about, because capitalism obviously isn't working for a lot of people and for the planet. This is a positive thing, but again, you got to get into what does that really mean? Because it doesn't mean liberal capitalism under, you know, Kane doesn't mean Keynesianism, like just throwing more money at social programs. As long as the capitalists are in power of the economy, they'll claw that money back at some point. And you have neoliberalism, which is a fancy term for doing that. Fancy term for taking social programs and increased taxes on corporations and basically getting rid of them, you know, or weakening them so much that the capitalists barely feel it. So again, thumbnail sketch there of socialism and what it really means. So back to that question, does it mean communism? Well, it means communism not in the sense of what Stalinism brought about or Maoism, but it means communism in the sense of, yeah, people should be equal and everyone should have a decent life on a world scale, not just in one country, and that that will take public ownership, people owning the economy, not just being used by the owners, a few owners of the economy. So to get that, to come at that another angle, as I started to say earlier in the show, there's been a lot of studies recently of Americans during this economic upswing, quote unquote, that we've been living through. What's it really like for working people, even when the stock market, not recently, it's actually been going down recently, but in the past was booming and unemployment was low. Well, you probably heard the stuff on the news about, well, workers, our pay is stagnant. We're not getting, even though we can find jobs, the low paying jobs, and so I always can't find jobs. There's always problems with those unemployment statistics, by the way. But where are we at really in terms of our personal, ability to survive in this system? And there's some with a stagnant wages for a long time or barely going up, with unions weakening, although that might be turning around now a little bit. What do you have? Well, you have these headlines like, this is from Barron's. This is from a business publication, Barron's, Barron, apostrophe S. They're, and also from Market Watch. Originally, Barron's then took this story. And then it says, quote, millions of Americans are just one paycheck away from financial disaster. Now, you might have heard that before, because there's been other, articles about this. And why would business put forward an article like this? Well, basically, they're trying to figure it out themselves sometimes, but on a very superficial basis, of why some of their stuff isn't selling. Why they put out stuff like this past Christmas time or holiday time, when the retail stores are expecting to make it big because people are going out buying presents, and if the economy is doing well, quote unquote, they should be buying more presents, and then it didn't happen. Oops. There wasn't enough consumers... purchasing. No, it wasn't enough activity to buy up all that stuff that got produced, or to buy it up at the prices the stores wanted to sell it at, the big corporations that own the stores. So why is that? Well, so they'll write something, one of these business publications will write something about some fact that came out. Now, do they connect the facts and make the right generalizations from those facts and understand the process of work? No. Not usually. Let me just try something here. Great. So anyway, that was a technical thing. Millions of Americans are just one paycheck away from financial disaster. Missing more than one paycheck is a one-way ticket to financial hardship for nearly half of the country's workforce. Wow, nearly half. That's interesting. 51%, this is from a study at the University of Chicago, from NORC, N-O-R-C, an independent social research institute, found that 51% of working adults in the United States would need to access savings to cover necessities if they missed more than one paycheck. Now, I'm living that dream myself and my family. In other words, if we missed a paycheck, we would have to dip into our savings. Oh, wait, there's a little problem, and you probably thought of it already. What savings, right? So that means credit cards. That means borrowing. So our savings is so little that, yeah, if we missed a paycheck, boom, we're down to more debt, and we're already in debt. So wait a minute, where does this cycle stop? Well, it doesn't. People are dying. I saw a picture the other day on Facebook of a person with actual student debts they were still paying. This was a very old person, older than me even, very old, paying student loans in retirement, supposedly, still trying to pay off student loans. So that's the thing. Debt is much worse than we are led to believe. It is something that people never get out of their whole lives. I mean, what is it when most of, and we kid ourselves about it, frankly, or that we're taught to kid ourselves about it. Because when you say you own a house, I own a house. Most people that say I own a house are people that are paying a bank that really owns the house. They're paying a mortgage. You don't really own the house. Miss a couple mortgage payments, you'll find out how quickly you don't own that house. Maybe you own the house. Maybe you actually paid it off. That's kind of puts you in a minority, but that's really interesting that you were able to do that. Then something happens, a medical expense in the country, the richest country in the world, without universal health care, without health care for everybody. Well, medical expense or whatever. And you end up paying, going into debt, going into bankruptcy, whatever. And you can't afford, you paid your house, that's great, but you can't afford repairs on the house. You can't or you can't afford property taxes on the house. If you're elderly, you might get a break on the property taxes. You're not going to get a break on the repair stuff. And people still that own their homes outright lose their homes. They can't keep up with the property taxes. They can't keep up with the repairs. So back to the main thing here, one paycheck away from financial disaster. Yes, it's true. I think it's true anecdotally. I think it's true in terms of the facts being presented here. Then it says that roughly 2/3 of households earning less than $30,000 annually and Hispanic households would be unable to cover basic living expenses after missing more than one paycheck. They also found many individuals still struggle to repay college loans, handle small emergency expenses, and manage retirement savings. And that's where I kind of laugh at manage retirement savings and that kind of talk. Here's a capitalist economy in the United States. It's the same worldwide, but sometimes the United States capitalists are out in front. In terms of the advanced capitalist countries, the industrialized capitalist countries, in terms of their nastiness. And the question of pensions, they've just been destroying pensions in the United States drastically. The figures on who actually still has a real pension is so low now. I think it was as low as 7% or something like that. Everyone else has these 401k programs or something like that, where depending on where you work, management may put in, the corporation may put in some money, or it may not. And either way, it's based on the stock market instead of a guaranteed, as what they used to call defined benefit. They still call defined benefit pension plan. So they're getting rid of defined benefit pension plans, getting rid of pension plans. And then they say, gee, you're not saving enough for, they get rid of your pension. Then they say you're not saving enough for retirement. Well, pensions existed precisely because workers could not save and cannot save enough for retirement for the most part. That you can't, that, you know, you get this check. It's not big enough. You can only slice it so many ways, right? I'm living that dream too, right? So many pulls on the check. So, you know, you got taxes, incredible amount of taxes, too many. Working people should have much lower taxes. You have the health care payments. You have dental payments. You have 401k and all that kind of stuff if you do that. And how many ways can you slice a check in terms of the actual net pay? And that's another thing. I mentioned this in the show before. But why do we kid ourselves about gross pay versus net pay? Gross pay means like what it says on paper or what they tell you you make a year, right? Or a week or a month. But net pay is what you really bring home and something you can turn into cash, something you can buy something with, like cash, you know? So I don't know about you, but my net pay is so much. I've counted, it's like $15,000 lower than my gross pay. So I have to fill out these forms for things, you know, financial aid for things and all this other stuff. I have to fill out forms for my kids and all that. And I got to put gross pay down. What? What are you talking about? You know, I don't want to put gross pay down. I don't want to have to talk to other people about how much I make a year. And quote gross pay. We should all be at the net pay level. We should say, I make this. This is what I bring home. This is what I can cash in the next day after I get paid from that check. That's what we should be talking about. And then they do actually in this article get into the savings question. Remember I said, what savings? Well, they say, well, Prosperity Now, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank focusing on expanding economic opportunity for low-income Americans. And I'll just add a ha there, said 40% of U.S. households lack a basic level of savings. 40% of households in the U.S. lack a basic level of savings. Yep, that's true. Then they come up with a fancy term for it. They call it liquid asset poor. These liquid asset poor households don't even have enough savings to live at the poverty level for 3 months if their income was interrupted. The poverty level. The data is even worse for people of color, with more than half households of color, 57%, being liquid asset poor, it found. 57%. Then there's the same group, Prosperity Now.